Hello and welcome to the History of Japan podcast, episode 470, The Vaccinators, Part 2. Last week we covered the long and circuitous route by which knowledge of smallpox vaccination made its way to Japan. It took 22 years from the invention of the vaccine by the English physician Edward Jenner in 1798, but in 1820 the Nagasaki-based translator Baba Sajiro completed a text on vaccination and how it worked. So, job done, right? Now all the information needed to create vaccines and crush one of the great scourges of human health is readily available. Surely, from this point onward, nothing can go wrong. Except, of course, not quite. For one thing, as anyone who has lived through, let's say, the past few years knows by now, it's one thing to have the technology required to create a vaccine. It's quite another to manage a massive rollout such that anyone at risk from the disease can be effectively immunized. After all, you need to train a bunch of people in how to administer vaccines and set up the logistics to transport your vaccines everywhere, which is quite a bit easier today in an age of mass refrigeration, as trying to keep the mild cowpox contagion alive long enough to transport it proved to be a bit of a trick. You also need massive public health campaigns to teach people the benefits of vaccination and overcome any hesitancy they might have around it. After all, on its face, the idea does sound kind of nuts, deliberately shoving some very gross diseased matter into your body so you will get kind of sick, but not badly sick, but don't worry because then you'll be immune? I mean, even for someone thoroughly convinced of the benefits, it sounds kind of insane. All of these issues apply to any vaccine rollout from smallpox to polio to COVID-19. But because a regular public health campaign was not tricky enough, there were some unique problems for anyone interested in distributing smallpox vaccines in Japan just to make things a little extra spicy. For one thing, while Baba Sajiro completed a translation of a text on smallpox vaccination prior to his death, he had done so without authorization as a part of the bureaucracy of the Tokugawa shogunate that was viewed, because of its contact with dangerous foreign ideas, with a bit of natural suspicion. As a result, Baba never tried to publish his work, which is, you know, pretty necessary for people to actually read it. That secrecy created other problems as well. We talked briefly last week about Nakagawa Goroji, who, when he was returned to Japan as a goodwill jester by the Russians, carried with him a booklet on smallpox vaccination, the same one Baba ended up translating. We've encountered Nakagawa before, actually, because after this point, he will become a smallpox vaccine booster, and among other things, will be hired by the shogunate to help vaccinate the Ainu of Hokkaido against smallpox, less as a goodwill gesture and more as a way to keep their numbers up and ward off Russian invasion. Thing is, Nakagawa actually refused to teach anyone else how to give vaccinations, treating it instead as a sort of secret knowledge only he could possess. Such an approach was not uncommon in Japan, at a time when schools of everything from martial arts to flower arranging prized their okuden, or inner transmissions, as special knowledge to be passed down only by those who had truly earned it. But one guy can't vaccinate an entire country, and it's also somewhat unclear, based on the records available, if Nakagawa even had access to cowpox lymph, or if he was simply faking the whole thing. Beyond these issues, the Tokugawa shogunate didn't really even have a public health infrastructure that could actually help promote vaccination. There was no samurai surgeon general of the shogunate, and even if there had been, the centralized feudalism of the early 1800s didn't really allow for a government-sponsored vaccine rollout in Japan. The central government of the Tokugawa shogunate had responsibility for things like defense issues or foreign affairs, but by long-standing tradition left the 270-odd feudal domains to manage their internal affairs so long as none of the nationwide laws, like, say, the ban on Christianity, were violated. Public health lay squarely in that internal affairs camp for the domains. There wasn't really any tradition of the central government stepping in to try and manage it. And most of the domains didn't really have a tradition of active intervention in public health either, of proactive measures like providing doctors or hospitals. To the extent domains did have health measures in place, they were often reactive. Quarantines of badly affected areas, or prayers in the name of the Lord at shrines and temples. Now, as we'll see, none of this should be taken as suggesting it would be impossible for either the shogunate or individual domains to run vaccination campaigns, but it did mean there wasn't really an existing playbook for how to implement them. And when you're trying to get vaccines out to the people, logistics can count for just as much, if not more, than pure scientific knowledge. So what did happen to the smallpox vaccine in Japan after 1820? To answer that question, we must return, once again, to the city of Nagasaki. In 1817, with the Napoleonic Wars now safely concluded, a newly independent Dutch government was able to resume its annual missions to the Dutch outpost at Nagasaki. Henrik Doof, the head of the mission, and the guy whose remarks about vaccination had gotten Baba Sadro interested in the topic, was finally rotated off and replaced with a new leader for the Dutch outpost, Jan Blomhoff. Blomhoff was apparently a big believer in smallpox vaccination, which by this point had a nearly 20-year history back in Europe, backing its effectiveness. And his correspondence makes it pretty clear that Blomhoff was a big believer in the vaccine and really wanted to see it find its footing in Japan. Why he felt so strongly is not entirely clear. It may have been on his mind because his son, when he left for Japan, was only 2, and thus squarely in the danger range for the disease himself. Whatever his reasons, by 1820, Blomhoff was writing back to the Dutch-controlled island of Java in what's now Indonesia, requesting cowpox lymph be shipped to Japan for a program of vaccination. By 1823, Dutch government records indicate that shipments of lymph for vaccination had become standard for all Dutch ships coming into Nagasaki. Clearly, the powers that be in Java agreed with Blomhoff's drive to promote the practice. Unfortunately, Blomhoff's early attempts were, well, not very effective. 3 things hindered his initial attempts to spread vaccination. First, explaining to Japanese who volunteered for the procedure exactly what was going on proved a bit of a challenge. Remember, vaccination involved a small amount of cowpox lymph being placed under the skin via incision. It absolutely had to be left there for the brief infection and immunity to function. However, inquisitive patients and their families would often remove bandages and pick at the vaccination sites, and if they didn't, curious Japanese doctors often would. This was the rationale given by Blomhoff in his report home in 1820 regarding why the initial round of vaccinations, done by the Dutch mission doctor Nicolaas Tulling, had failed to take. Second, it must be remembered that foreigners were not exactly viewed with friendly eyes by average Japanese people, even in Nagasaki, where they were at least an occasional sight. Requests by the Dutch that local children be sent to their mission on the isolated artificial island of Deshima in Nagasaki's harbor proved a difficult sell, to put it mildly, and that was assuming the Japanese officials who were constantly rotated through the Dutch mission, to make sure none of them became too friendly with the Dutch and broke the rules for them, were willing to allow kids onto the island at all. As a result, many of the patients in Blomhoff's vaccination drive were older, in their mid to late teens, and thus likely had been exposed to smallpox already. Having survived, they were now immune. Third, and this would prove an issue for decades to come, the lymph used in vaccinations has to be prepared before insertion and set up in storage to be shipped around. You can't just run off and grab the nearest sick cow. So prepared lymph had to be shipped in from the Dutch outpost in Java, and even with careful packaging procedures, it was not easy to ensure the lymph survived the journey. Biological material is often pretty volatile, after all, and it would very often spoil in transit and become useless. Still, Blomhoff's enthusiasm for vaccination gave him admirers, as did his concern, which appears to have been totally genuine, for the health and well-being of Japanese children. In particular, 2 Japanese doctors, Minato Choan and Mima Junzo, were by early 1823 working with Blomhoff as medical assistants and helping to explain to patients what exactly was being done to them and why, even if they really wanted to, they shouldn't go peeking under their bandages. Both Minato and Mima were Rangaksha, students of Dutch learning, as it was called, since the only way to get your hands on Western texts was by buying them from the Dutch. Both had studied in Edo and specialized in medicine, and when they heard strange tellings that the Dutch in Nagasaki were now saying they could prevent the deadly smallpox disease by cutting your arm a bit and shoving some gross stuff from cows into it, well, that's the kind of thing you have to see to believe, right? Minato and Mima both had the chance to begin picking up the basics of vaccination with a round of cowpox lymph provided by the Dutch in May 1823. However, they would not have long to work with Blomhoff or his physician Nicholas Tulling, as their three-year rotation in Japan came to an end in the fall of that year. Still, their timing was good in two respects. First, both Blomhoff and Tulling had, despite their mixed success in their vaccination efforts, managed to make friends among the Nagasaki leadership. The shogun's officials in Nagasaki, which because of its value in the foreign trade was managed directly by the shogunate, had come to trust their good intentions, and more broadly the intentions of the Dutch in teaching Western medicine and vaccination. Second, the replacements sent for Blomhoff and Tulling proved very fortuitous. The new head of the Dutch mission, Johann Wilhelm de Sertler, was not particularly notable and served a basic three-year term in Japan. But his physician was another matter. Philip Franz von Siebold is, in fact, so famous that we've already done a whole episode on him. I will not retread that ground here. You can check out episode 248 if you're curious about Siebold's career specifically. For a quick refresh on what matters to us about him, Siebold was a German-born and university-trained doctor who volunteered to join the Dutch military for a chance to travel abroad. Given the chance to go to Japan, a place most people from Europe would never be allowed to see, he jumped at the opportunity. Siebold was a born scientist, interested in cataloging everything from flora and fauna to ritual and religion. This is in fact what he is best known for. His accounts of what he saw in Japan, as well as his translations of Japanese texts, make him a fascinating window into the tail end of feudalism in Japan. For us, however, what matters most is Siebold's medical practice. Upon arriving in Japan, he was quickly contacted by Narabayashi Sōken, a Nagasaki-based scholar of Rangaku, or Dutch, Western studies. Narabayashi was from one of the hereditary families of interpreters maintained by the shogunate to handle the Dutch language and facilitate trade. The Narabayashi family specifically also had an established tradition of working on the side, as scholars of Dutch knowledge, particularly medicine. So Narabayashi Sōken was naturally very thrilled to have a chance to speak with someone who had trained in medicine at an elite European university. Initially, Narabayashi and a few other Dutch-speaking facilitators came with students to Deshima, the artificial island in Nagasaki Harbor, to take lessons in Western medicine provided by Siebold. Siebold's instruction, in the preferred standard of the time, was a combination of lectures on everything from anatomy to medical botany, combined with lab practice where he would demonstrate techniques. Eventually, however, Narabayashi was able to use his influence to get Siebold permission, rather unusual by the 1800s, though it had been more common in the past, to leave Deshima Island and venture into Nagasaki proper. By mid-1824, Siebold and Narayashi received permission from the Machi Bugyo, or city magistrate, to construct a combination clinic and school on the outskirts of Nagasaki. The site of that clinic, called the Narutaki School, now houses a museum dedicated to Siebold's time in Japan. The Narutaki School would eventually take about 50 students a year, either associated with the Narabayashi family or the broader world of medicine-focused Rangaku, which was called Ranpo, or Dutch medicine, to distinguish it from Kanpo, traditional Chinese medicine. Siebold took several doctors with prior knowledge of Western medicine into his faculty. For example, Mima Junzo, one of the doctors who had helped the previous Dutch resident physician Nicholas Tulling administer vaccines, was one of his teaching assistants. Siebold, by the way, did not collect tuition from any of these students. He was paid instead in information in the form of everything from biological samples to notes on Japanese medical, religious, social, and other practices. Students would produce dissertations on their samples in the style of an essay, and be awarded a diploma with a red wax seal on it like a European university upon completing it, entitling them in turn to learn at the Narutaki school and then demonstrate their affiliation with the school. The material he collected in this way formed the basis of Siebold's writings on Japan, most famously his work Nippon, which made him famous around Europe when he returned home. Siebold's influence wasn't just confined to Nagasaki. In 1826, he was part of the Dutch mission dispatched to Edo for the practice of Sankin Kotai. The Dutch, like Japan's feudal lords, were expected to go to the shogun on a regular basis and attend to him in person. Part of that process for the Dutch involved meetings with the shogun and members of his court to provide demonstrations and information about the West. Siebold, of course, was brought along to show off his medical knowledge. All along the way, one of the things he was teaching was the art of vaccination. By this point, the yearly Dutch trade ship coming to Nagasaki was always carrying cowpox lymph, and so the Narutaki school became, in a sense, Japan's first vaccination clinic. On the 1826 trip to Edo, Siebold performed several vaccinations in front of doctors for the shogun and his family, albeit only for demonstration purposes, given that Siebold himself noted the lymph he was using was pretty old and likely no longer active or capable of triggering an immune response. Still, the shogun's doctors were intrigued, and things looked promising. Despite this promising moment, however, Siebold's career in Japan would not end on a very high note. He seems to have hoped the shogun would allow him to remain in Edo and begin a campaign of mass vaccination there, but no such permission was forthcoming, which is just as well as Siebold had no clear plan to get the amount of cowpox lymph he would need to do this. Eventually, Siebold himself would be forced to leave Japan altogether in 1829, after he was found to have taken back from Edo several prohibited items, most notably maps of northern Japan, leading to fears he was a Russian spy helping the Tsar to subvert the area's defenses. The so-called Siebold incident didn't just force the doctor out of the country, many of his close associates, including Rangaku scholars back in Edo who were found to have illegally provided him with materials, were imprisoned and executed. The details of the whole Siebold incident are, again, beyond what we have time for here. I'd urge you to go back and look at the previous episode on him if you want to know more about it, or his career in general. What matters for us about Siebold is that while he was in Japan, he had a pretty high profile among Rangaksha, and especially Ranpo medicinal practitioners, who were focused on Dutch and Western techniques. Siebold was, in a sense, a sort of celebrity among the medical community, especially Ranpo doctors, whose appearance helped bolster interest in Dutch medicine more generally, including vaccination. His time in Japan also helped to level out connections between Ranpo doctors, in a sense. This is a bit tricky to think about, but bear with me here. Up until this point, Ranpo medicine was divided, like pretty much every other skill set in Japanese history, into various competing ryuha, or schools. These ryuha would be associated with a foundational figure whose knowledge was then passed down to students, with only the best students receiving access to the most advanced information. The relationship was practically familial. Indeed, leadership of a ryuha was often passed down within a single family, and if no suitable heir was available in the next generation, one would be adopted from the ranks of leading students. This approach to organizing knowledge was used in everything from the martial arts to calligraphy, including medicine, and it is remarkably effective at passing knowledge down. But the competing schools approach does not, unfortunately, do a great job of facilitating cooperation between people from different schools. Siebold, however, helped break down the walls between the schools of Ranpo. Doctors from different ryuha who studied with him were suddenly linked by a shared teacher in a way that encouraged the construction not of a vertical relationship, master and student with one person the superior, but a horizontal one, shared learning from a single instructor. The value of this in terms of building connections between practitioners of Ranpo and getting them to share knowledge is hard to understate. It helped that many of the Ronpo doctors out there were already very devoted to their craft and not of particularly high status themselves. Most Ronpo doctors were either from the upper ranks of the peasantry, in which case they were looking for a new career to enhance their social prestige, and maybe even get them out of the countryside and into the big cities, or the second or third sons of samurai families who were locked out from inheriting the family job, which at any rate would not be enough to sustain the family given the meager nature of samurai stipends. For both of these groups, a career in medicine provided an alternative path to earning a living and climbing a social hierarchy that was nominally frozen in place. Ronpo medicine specifically was a career that required a lot of passion and skill. The requirement to be able to read Dutch texts alone meant that most doctors were in their 30s or 40s by the time they actually started learning medical techniques. In her seminal study of smallpox vaccination in Japan, Dr. Ann Janetta focuses on the biographies of seven men who became Ronpo doctors and were particularly involved in the spreading of vaccination as a practice. She found several interesting commonalities. Of the seven, all but one were either farmers or the second or third sons of low-ranking samurai families. The seventh was the son of a practitioner of Kanpo, or traditional Chinese medicine. In other words, all of them came from backgrounds where social mobility was a major concern. For example, probably the most famous of these doctors is Ogata Koan, the third son of a samurai family born in 1810. Ogata would, at the age of 15, ask his parents to adopt him into another family. He claimed, in the letter making this request, that he was asking because his physical frailty made him ill-suited for the life of a warrior, but likely he'd been coached to say that by his parents, who knew that a third son didn't have great prospects in a warrior class where there already weren't enough jobs to go around. By 1826, Ogata was enrolled in a school of traditional Chinese medicine at Osaka, and there discovered an interest in Western medical techniques, eventually moving to Edo and studying with scholars there. By 1836, he was running his own school of Dutch medicine in Osaka. Another example is Sato Taizen, born in 1804 to Sato Tosuke, a peasant from northern Japan. Tosuke, like many peasants in the 1800s, left the countryside and came to Edo looking for employment. He would find it in the Ina family, a household of samurai Hatamoto, or direct retainers to the shogun. And Tosuke would arrange for his young son to study with the Ina family heir, giving him access to an education that in turn would open up several new potential careers, including medicine. Taizen's education would eventually allow him to get his foot in the door at one of Edo's academies devoted to Ronpo, and from there he would go on to become a well-known scholar of the subject. Both Ogata and Sato would go on to study with former students of Siebold. Both would also spend time in Nagasaki, though post-Siebold it was no longer possible to meet directly with the Dutch, and the acquisition of Dutch-language books became much harder than it had been. Still, Nagasaki had more schools and scholars devoted to the study of things Western than anywhere else, and more speakers of Dutch as a language, and thus was a desirable place to study. For Janetta, biographies like this demonstrated a few things. First, these doctors were coming from the same social groups that eventually helped drive the overthrow of Japanese feudalism, upper peasants and lower samurai. These were people with enough status and wealth to be educated and thus politically active, but who ran up against firm barriers to their advancement politically and socially created by the shogunate and the feudal social system. Medicine was, for many of these doctors, a way to circumvent those barriers and climb socially, and their backgrounds meant these men were less concerned than those of high status about a career in something non-traditional, like Western medicine. Second, these men traveled a lot. They moved between schools in cities like Edo, Osaka, and Nagasaki because scholarship was, after all, a reasonable reason to request a travel permit and circumvent the rules intended to keep the population from moving around too much. In the course of moving around so much, the doctors began to create medical networks of professionals around the country. They knew people far away from themselves, in other words. That's the kind of thing you might need to call on for, say, a campaign of mass vaccination. Third, these doctors were talking across schools. They often shared translations of Dutch medical texts, the most recent ones they could get, where in the past, not as much attention had been paid to the recency of material. Sato produced a translation of a work on bone setting in 1830. Ogata translated a text on vaccination in 1836. Ogata also worked on Japan's first medical journal, Taisei Meii Iko, or the Journal of Articles by Western Physicians, in imitation of the medical journals brought to Japan by Siebold. The journal only ran for a few years, but included work by Ogata as well as several other students from different lineages, a few of whom had worked directly with Siebold. All of this is a very elaborate way of saying that, to borrow Janetta's words, these scholars had begun to construct a professional network, the same kind of network that, say, ties me to other teachers when we talk about our ideas at conferences or online, and those kind of professional networks are crucial to distributing ideas and practices within a profession, ideas like vaccination. Indeed, by the mid-1830s, this network of doctors was already beginning to spread the related practice of variolation, the use of infected matter from smallpox, which does produce immunity but is way more dangerous than the cowpox vaccine, though still less dangerous than catching live, full-strength smallpox. Sato Taizen, for example, variolated his own son in 1836. The technique never really caught on, though. Even though the danger was reduced, it was not zero, and so generally people were only willing to use variolation during larger smallpox outbreaks when the risk of their kids contracting the live disease was much higher. Probably the single most important thing this network of doctors accomplished was finding the ears of sympathetic daimyo, the regional feudal lords, who could be convinced of the value of Dutch medicine and especially of vaccination. Such men were useful both for the obvious reasons, their patronage was a source of extremely useful financial support, and because of their government connections. Those connections were absolutely essential. After the Siebold incident, it had become nearly impossible for Ronpo physicians to talk directly with the Dutch on Deshima, given the shogun's growing fear of Western spies. This meant that, even as in the 1830s, a consensus was building in Japan about the effectiveness of Jennerian-style vaccination, it was not possible for the doctors so convinced to, say, request a shipment of cowpox lymph or scabs from the Dutch to start vaccinations with. Daimyo, however, could place orders directly with the Dutch, and so during the 1830s, many Ronpo physicians from this network poured their time and attention into convincing major daimyo of the utility of vaccination, for example by providing them with translations of the latest Western medical techniques, endorsing the practice as both effective and less dangerous than variolation. And this began to pay dividends. By the 1840s, some of Japan's most powerful daimyo had come around to the practice. For example, Nabeshima Naomasa, the lord of Saga province right next to Nagasaki, and one of very few Kunimochi daimyo, a lord who ruled outright one of Japan's 60-odd provinces, eventually endorsed vaccination. Nabeshima wasn't even the biggest get. By the mid-1840s, two members of the Roju, the Council of Senior Advisors to the Shogun, were vaccination supporters. We've actually encountered both their names before, Abe Masahiro and Hotta Masayoshi, who together would lead the shogunate through the 1850s and the early years of the foreign crisis after the arrival of the Americans in Edo in 1853. As early as 1843, these daimyo were writing to the Dutch with requests for assistance in a vaccine program, but the actual importation of materials for the vaccine was held up until 1849, largely because of uncertainties between the daimyo and the shogunate as to whether the shogun needed to give his permission for this new technology to be imported. After all, one of the ways the shogun maintained his control over Japan's political system was by carefully controlling the importing of Western technology, thus ensuring that no one daimyo was able to, say, buy a bunch of modern weapons and overthrow the shogunate. Years of political maneuvering in Edo finally culminated in a request to the Dutch on behalf of the Shogun in 1848, and the next year's Dutch trade ship, the Stad Dordrecht, delivered a shipment of lymph to Otto Monicke, the German-born physician stationed in Deshima at that time. From this point onward, progress was frankly pretty incredible. Monicke himself does deserve a lot of the credit for this. He had already thought pretty carefully and come up with a clever plan to distribute the vaccine. You see, cowpox lymph, once inserted under the skin, can actually remain stable for a pretty long time and be carefully reapplied once the vaccine is complete to spread immunity. So Monicke arranged for children to come from all over Kyushu to Nagasaki, working through Nagasaki's Machibugyo, or city magistrate appointed by the shogun, in order to set this up. Once the children had come to Nagasaki, they were vaccinated in the presence of Japanese doctors observing how to perform the procedure. The kids could then serve as carriers of the vaccine back to their own region, where the doctors who had seen it done could reapply the vaccine and spread it around. The result was absolutely incredible. With the cooperation of Major Daimyo and the support of Ronpo physicians who had studied the procedure carefully, aided by the rediscovery of Baba Sajiro's translation, which, thanks to lords like Hota and Abe, was taken out of mothballs and used to train vaccinators, the vaccine spread rapidly around the country. Indeed, it turned out that despite Baba's manuscript being unpublished, it or other tracts like it, like a text on vaccination translated by Sato Taizen in 1836, had already been secretly circulating for years via hand-copied manuscripts. As a result, many Ronpo physicians already knew how vaccination worked and were prepared to do the procedure. The Stad Dordrecht and its vaccine shipment arrived on August 11, 1849. By the end of the year, vaccinations using its lymph were taking place as far away as remote outposts in the Kurile Islands or Sakhalin in the far north of the country. Dr. Monicke himself vaccinated a few hundred children in Nagasaki, around 150 in the first few weeks, but estimated that by the end of the year, thousands of children had been made immune to one of the great ravages of the age. Of course, in a country with an estimated population of around 30 million at the time, that was just a drop in the bucket, but a pretty big drop, nonetheless. None of this, by the way, took place with the official permission of the shogunate. In fact, just a few months before the start of this vaccination wave in 1849, the shogunate had actually banned the practice of Western-style medicine in its territory. That decision was driven by leading doctors at the shogun's official school of Chinese medicine, the Iga-kan, particularly its leader, Taki Mototaka. The Taki clan had long been the official physicians of the shogun since the 1750s. They were concerned about losing their influence to Western-style doctors. Shogunal officials themselves were in no hurry to publicly embrace Western innovations, to be fair. After all, doing so would undermine a long-cherished institution of the shogunate in the policy of seclusion. Admitting, after all, that Western doctors had produced such an amazing invention, and what's more, had done it 50 years earlier at this point, would raise some serious questions about what exactly the benefits of seclusion really were. However, the shogunate did not actively seek to discourage vaccination either. Indeed, much of the 1849 arm-to-arm distribution took place in cities controlled by the shogun directly, like Edo, Osaka, or of course Nagasaki itself. Reading between the lines, the decision seems to have been to maintain the law as it stood on the books, but not to enforce it. Thus, if vaccination went well, the shogunate could benefit from it, but it had plausible deniability if things went poorly, and the policy of seclusion could be protected. As Dr. Monicke himself, the doctor who started this vaccination drive, put it in one of his letters, quote, "The central government at Edo is fully aware of the great importance of vaccination and secretly encourages its introduction, but there still exists no official policy for this. The government of Japan considers vaccination a foreign institution entering the country, and therefore at odds with the policy of isolation." It wasn't until the late 1850s that the shogunate began to actively encourage smallpox vaccination, for example, funding a clinic in Hokkaido to vaccinate the local population. But most vaccination drives remained thoroughly private affairs. For example, a clinic opened up by Otsuki Shunsai on the outskirts of Edo, next to the Buddhist temple Seiganji, known as the Otamagaike Vaccination Clinic. Initiatives like this received permission from the shogunate, but no government backing. It wasn't until after the end of feudalism and the establishment of the new Meiji Imperial State that vaccination was made mandatory and even given official backing, a policy instituted by one of Ogata Koan's former students, Nagayo Sensei, who held positions in the education and home ministries, which he used to boost the practice. The results were extremely impressive. In 1886, a smallpox epidemic resulted in 73,000 cases around Japan and just over 18,000 deaths. By 1905, a new epidemic saw only 10,000 cases and 3,000 deaths. Smallpox would not be declared eradicated from Japan until the 1950s, but the work was clearly underway. So what does this story tell us? Well, for me, I think the most obvious historical lesson was the result of the seclusion policy. It's indisputable, I think, that the policy massively delayed the advent of smallpox vaccination in Japan, an obviously beneficial procedure that has saved untold millions of lives. The seclusion policy was intended to protect the social and political balance that underlay the Tokugawa system, but as we've seen, it also stifled innovation and the adoption of obviously beneficial ideas. After all, it took 47 years from the first mention of vaccination in Japan to the first substantial vaccination campaign. Beyond this, the value of that network of Ronpo physicians cannot, to my mind, be overstated. Perhaps it's my memories of the pandemic influencing my thinking, but I see a lot of parallels in terms of the value of a network of people capable of making the case for vaccination and its value, and who are able to rapidly and swiftly deliver a life-saving medical procedure when called upon to do so. The value of those professional networks and the ability to take pure knowledge and put into place the logistics to translate it into action, well, it's hard to undersell that. Smallpox was, for most of our history, a scourge upon the earth. Its eradication is probably one of the greatest accomplishments of the modern era. But the path there was not an easy one, and the people who walked it for us deserve all the recognition we can give them. That's all for this week. Thank you very much for listening. This show is part of the Facing Backward Podcast Network. You can find out more about this show and our other shows at facingbackward.com. You can support the network at patreon.com/facingbackward. Special thanks to those who have given at our shout-out tier: Jan Leonard, Stephen Elkins, Martin Oliveira, Clark Canning, Ian Kellett, Matt Haynes, Jackie Frostocker, Monkey Sack, Alayla McCulloch, Karen Murphy, Peter Wales, Robert Prine, William Arno, Jonas Brandis, Nicholas Kroll, Jerry Spinrad, Jared Stevens, Jeffrey Dwork, Stefan Hruschka, Joshua Kane, Robbie and Cat, Jacob Key, A House is a Perfectly Cromulent Mascot, and The Fish I Catch Are Rhodes Scholars Compared to Samuel Alito, Schmuck. Special thanks also to new donors to the History of Japan Patreon, Jason and Chris. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next time for an episode on one of the more obscure incidents of the early Meiji period, the Osaka Incident.